You know, most days I feel like a complete and utter bozo when I wake up, and this morning was no different. Reason being, I realized that when I was recording this episode of Hashtag CNF, a podcast where I speak with creators of nonfiction, my good mic, this one, wasn't on. So, you know, my microphone usually defaults to being on in my software, but this time only the built-in commuter mic was used, so I sound a little bit echoey, but I don't think it's distractedly so, so I probably shouldn't have said anything. Tom McAllister, at @T_McAllister on Twitter, on the other hand, sounds downright regal. Tom makes his triumphant return to Hashtag CNF for episode number 35. He's a professor at Temple University, the nonfiction editor for Barrel House magazine, the author of Bury Me in My Jersey, a memoir of his father, football in Philly, and the author of the forthcoming novel, The Young Widower's Handbook. He's also the co-host of the podcast Book Fight, which he and Mike Ingram started in 2012. And that's where this conversation starts, more or less, about podcasting. Lastly, Hashtag CNF can now be found on Google Play Music, as well as iTunes, as it has. So be sure to subscribe with whatever mobile device you own. Tweet at me, at Brendan O'Mara, with feedback or questions. And be sure to subscribe to my book recommendations newsletter. That's about it. Let's get rolling. Tom McAllister is back, baby.
Yeah, man. So, how you been? Like I said, we haven't actually spoken in about 3 years.
Yes, I'm all right. I mean, I just got back from teaching a class, which is going fine so far. We're only at the end of week two, so it's still salvageable. But so far, it's been a rocky start in a couple of the classes as far as people actually, doing the reading, showing up. Making eye contact, all the basics.
Yeah, but, do you find that the first 2 weeks are hard to get the momentum going in your classes?
Yeah, there's so much luck involved, right? Like last semester, I got lucky that I had a couple of really good groups, and so on day one, before when I was just doing the syllabus, there was like we somehow accidentally stumbled into a conversation about stuff, and so then we kind of just rolled from there. Like there was already like this immediate chemistry. And actually, I have a fiction class, and that's going great. But I have these two freshman comp classes, and right now, today it was just like I was begging them to do anything. So we'll see. I've got to have to. Sometimes they come around, though. Sometimes it's just like they need to learn what I want, and they have to understand my sense of humor and the way that I'm approaching things. I guess to develop a trust, right? But yeah. First week, first full week. Thumbs down.
So yeah, it being the new year and all, still kind of I've been asking, you know, our recent guests like how they've been processing the past year and then kind of what they plan on doing, you know, writer goal wise reading goals and forging a path through the new year. And I wonder for you, like, how have you been processing what happened in the past year, and like, what are your goals for the upcoming year? Especially since you've got the book coming out, the novel.
Yeah, man, I don't know how I'm processing. I'd say I'm processing the past year very badly. it's just like I'm trying every day to find an appropriate balance between reading kind of horrifying news stories and being aware of what's happening, and also still being a functional person and not, you know, in a state of constant like panic. Some days have been better than others on that front. Like we're recording this the day after there was a real flurry of activity from the new president. That caused a real
God.
Goals. He said writing goals. I'm trying. So this is a really vague reading goal, but in the past couple months there was a lot of people writing, basically sharing lists of books and novels that are written by and about countries under authoritarian rule and things like that, I guess for obvious reasons. So at least for now, that's what I've been trying to read. Like I just read this book called Nothing is True and Anything is Possible. It's a nonfiction thing about by a reality TV producer who worked in Russia about kind of the way that truth is controlled there and created. It's pretty interesting, although, again, I don't know if I can stick to it for that long, because there's going to be days where I feel really shitty, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I'm on the West Coast now, and so, like, when I wake up in the morning and I, like, you know, look at the news, like, the East Coast has already been firing for 3 or 4 hours,
yeah.
and I'm just like, oh my God, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, there's not a day to catch your breath yet. It's it's something. It is overwhelming.
Yeah. So as creators of some sort, you know, we kind of soldier on, and it's funny. I was given that you podcast them well as well, and have been doing it since before the big podcast boom with Book Fight. I kind of wanted to talk about that a little bit as well, and
sure.
going back to that, and what made you and Mike Ingram want to start it.
So we started in, I think our first episode posted April 1st, 2012 or thereabouts. And so, yeah, we're coming up on 5 years of just about weekly episodes. And we started really because Mike had started listening to a lot of podcasts. He listened to a lot, started with comedy podcasts. And then he started looking for a book podcast, and he just couldn't find one that he wanted, that he liked. They were at least the ones that he was listening to then. He felt we're all just kind of like too serious or too dry, or, you know, it was like the This American Life or something, which is its own thing, or the New Yorker podcast. And so then he told me he really would love a book podcast that is a little looser, that has more of a feeling of kind of camaraderie and friendship and, you know, digression and all the kind of the conversations we would be having anyway. And so then he kind of just talked me into it, because at that point I don't think I'd even listened to a podcast. And so he sent me a bunch of homework. He emailed me links to like a dozen podcasts that he liked and said, listen to these and see what you think. And then we just started rolling. I mean, for about the first year, we had to figure a lot of stuff out about the basics of how things work. I feel like we hit sort of a comfort zone after that.
So what did that look like what were some of those early hiccups and growing pains that you guys experienced technically, and also maybe the, you know, how you decided to format the show?
Yeah. So, I mean, first definitely was figuring out how audio works. Mike does all the editing, and so he figured out a lot of stuff about basic editing skills and how to do it a little more quickly. And then we had some issues with audio, and we tried to have guests in, then we had to upgrade our equipment and everything. And then it was a lot of, figuring out, because Mike and I can talk forever. We've been friends for a long time. We can just go and talk on any topic, but we realized a lot of the early episodes were just sort of hard to follow, or we repeated ourselves a ton and we didn't really have any particular goal. And so we ended up imposing, I guess what you may call a loose structure on the show, where it opens up with like a little, you know, greeting, and then if we'll spend, you know, the first 25 minutes talking about whatever thing we read, go to a break, and the break is really good for us to regroup and say, like, oh, wait, have we messed anything up? And then now we've, over the 4.5 years, almost 5 years, we've come up with a variety of kind of little segments that we sometimes sprinkle in. Like Mike does the somewhat beloved segment called Fan Fiction Corner, where he'll pull up some very bizarre fan fiction from the internet. Some interesting stuff, a lot of really bizarre stuff. That's probably our most regular recurring segment. And anyway, the point is we ended up building in little segments that kind of force us to stay on task, so that now we can pretty comfortably record an hour episode in like an hour and 10 minutes. Whereas before, to record an hour episode, we probably sat here for 2.5 hours and then, you know, had to cut a lot of nonsense out.
And early on, were you able to adhere to at least a strict publishing schedule? Like, you were able to at least have that kind of momentum in place?
Yeah, that was one that we agreed like basically had to happen, because it was, you know, that's some podcasts that Mike had subscribed to that would post irregularly, or like once every 6 weeks, or, and he would just forget to listen. And so we said, like, whatever we do, we got to be posting once a week. And that's why we ended up doing, it would be too much for us with our actual lives to try to do a book a week. And that's why we started doing short essays and stories. And also for a while we were doing like a, I guess an advice type thing on more of a question answering. It wasn't so much advice, but yeah, I think we've only missed probably about 5 weeks in those years, and three of them were scheduled weeks off where after Christmas we just said we'll take a week off and, you know, catch our breath.
And at what point did you guys notice that there was a significant or serious uptick in popularity when you were able to, when things were snowballing and like, oh, okay, that doesn't feel like we're just shouting into the abyss?
Yeah, because that's like the first, especially the first 10, I was like, probably a couple of our friends are listening, probably my brother's listening, and I don't know who else. And, I mean, one of our friends told us that he found the first five episodes unlistenable, and I think it was probably about, we started to gradually get a little bit more feedback from people who we had never heard of, so that was nice. We're like, oh, okay, at least someone who we hadn't met before is listening. And then I'm trying to think, the first kind of big bump we got had to have been, so the biggest bump we ever got was there was a brief period where the website, the AV Club, was covering our podcast weekly, and we saw a pretty significant jump in listenership from that. But there must have been a bump right before, you know, about a 6 months before that got us even on their radar. And I'm trying to think of what that would have been. I don't know if it's just, and we use, we're both editors at Barrel House magazine, and so we use that to promote a lot. So maybe it was just thanks to the Barrel House Facebook page that we ended up kind of gradually accruing enough people to get some of that momentum.
If you were starting the podcast, say, today, knowing what you know, what might you do differently?
Good question. I think the biggest thing that we would do differently is probably having started with slightly more of a structure, because we resisted that idea of structure at first because we said we don't want to be too dry and bland and everything else. But you need some sort of structure because you're inviting strangers to listen to you talk for an hour or more every week, and so they need to have a little bit they can count on. And the other thing, and this is a thing that we've gotten a little bit better at. Early on, we were very reluctant to invite guests on because I actually didn't want to bother people. We're basically assigning them homework because we're saying you have to read a book. And we probably would have been a little more aggressive in trying to get some guests on who we otherwise, you know, were reluctant to invite.
Yeah, those are some of your better episodes, I think, when you bring in someone else, or bring in someone who's also a writer too. Like, I think you had Justin St. Germain on one time. Yeah. He wrote Son of a Gun, and so that's kind of neat. It's like this little wild card that kind of just, it's this little aberrant spike in maybe the complacent ear, and it's like a nice little change of pace, but it's still like, for to sound business schooly, like on brand.
Yes. Yeah, that's, I mean, the best guests we've had have been the ones, and it's been, we've been happy, we've been lucky that, like, for inviting just sometimes complete strangers to my basement, everyone's worked out pretty well. But the best guests we've had have been the people who, yeah, just, like, jump right in and are willing to start arguing with us right away or whatever. And I like, just from a sort of a auditory perspective, I like when we have a female guest on because it breaks up the monotony. It's not three male voices.
Yeah.
It sounds a little, and people always tell us they can't tell our voices apart anyway, and so sometimes adding in another male voice that sounds sort of similar isn't ideal, or isn't the it's not what everyone's clamoring for. But yeah, it's been, I like the, I mean, the guests are fun. They break things up, and they also make us read things that we would never otherwise pick sometimes.
What does your, like, quote unquote recording studio look like?
So we have an IKEA table. It's just like a, you know, what would be, I guess, a small kitchen table. We're down in my basement. I have like a finished basement, and we're just kind of off in the corner of it. I think we picked the basement, well, because it's out of the way, but also because it's not too echoey. And we have pretty decent audio equipment now. In the past, when we started, we sat on folding chairs and had just a single, like a snowball mic, which is kind of a, basically we got it because it's like a starter mic because it's not that expensive. So if we decided not to do it anymore, it wouldn't kill us.
Yeah, that's what I use right now just for talking into the Skype recordings is the blue snowball thing.
It does
the trick for you. And it, like you said, it's pretty cheap.
Yeah, it's actually pretty good quality. Especially for an individual speaking into it, it's actually really good for just especially if you're in a quiet room. We had that for a while. Then we did some fundraising and we ended up getting some pretty good mics. So we have we got three mic stands set up here and trying to look at the brand of them. Shure brand mics. So it's probably about $600 worth of equipment down here now, actually.
Mm, that's awesome.
But that was, yeah. And I felt that it really did. Well, it made us look more like a recording studio when we have guests in, but it also, I think the audio quality, I think, does come through.
Yeah. Do you put up any like egg carton type stuff on the walls yet? Or do you just,
yeah, we've talked about it and then we never follow through. I don't know that my wife would love that. So that is one thing we could do actually to kind of trap the noise a little bit better than we do.
And so how important do you think the podcast itself has helped your writing?
I think one thing it definitely makes me think about, it definitely, when you sit down to write, right, you have this abstract idea of an audience or what is a reader going to think when they read this. And then, every week sitting down to sometimes harshly critique stories or essay or books is a reminder that there is like an actual living audience there that my book's coming out in a couple of weeks. And I don't think I'd have the stomach to listen to another podcast talking about my book the way that we talk about other people's books. And not that we're always destroying other people's books, but we have a pretty idiosyncratic response to certain books, or sometimes one of us really hates one or whatever. And it does, it's affected me in this way that because half the books I read in a year now are basically dictated by Mike because we alternate book picks. It has exposed me to some different types of writing where that I would not have otherwise done. There was a point where he was reading a lot of and basically assigning me a lot of short nonfiction books that have like lots of like little vignettes in them, basically like DJ Waldie's Holy Land. And I really liked the voice of a lot of those. What's the other one? I think this is probably fiction. Renata Adler's Speedboat, but there are some others, and that definitely got into my head a little bit. And so the thing I'm working on now actually borrows a lot from those kinds of voices.
During our last conversation, we talked a lot about community, and specifically the community that you were looking to find, and the subject which were. Of Bury Me in My Jersey. And I wonder if you think do you think the podcast itself has provided you with a lot of that community that you were looking for and then, subsequently wrote about in your memoir?
Yeah, definitely. And it's like, I actually wrote a thing not too long ago for the website, The Millions, that where I talked a little bit about that, where it was like, I emailed a bunch of other, podcasters to ask, what do you get out of it? How does this change the way you think about books and stuff? And they all basically said the same thing, which is that they feel like the value of it is not that they're offering some critique of where the thing belongs in the canon, but that they're building a sense of community around the things they're talking about. So that listeners are really interested, not so much in whether this is a great book, but in whether Tom and Mike, these people who I spend time with every week, what did they think of it? And so now, it's been really cool that we've got enough listeners where we've got a kind of a cluster of regular listeners who interact with us all the time on Twitter and Facebook and email. And they're people who we never met otherwise. They're just a lot of, they're in librarians in the Midwest or they're wherever they are. And but I feel like there's like a certain intimacy that you develop with people that you that I didn't really expect. Actually, I went in, I guess, with no expectations, and it's pretty cool to have that building around kind of a stupid thing that Mike and I do.
Yeah, the audio has a certain intimacy about it, especially if you're walking around by yourself with headphones on. It almost you feel really plugged in to a conversation like that. You really feel like you're there, And like I think you said, it does, even when you're, like, if I'm over here in Oregon, but if, you know, I'm listening to a book fight, I feel like I'm kind of in your basement, like, you know, just kind of eavesdropping on a cool conversation about stuff I like, you know, reading and writing. And,
right.
You know, similarly, especially when I was living by myself, I would get home from, you know, work late at night, working at the newspaper, and I would put in like old Simpson DVDs and I'd watch these episodes a million times. So I would turn on the commentary, and like having the commentary, it like felt like I had, it's kind of sad, but it's, but I felt like I had a little group of buddies there as we were watching this episode of The Simpsons. And it's, I don't know, it's similarly like that, like finding like you found your own tribe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of, I think that's the motivation for a lot of people who are listening. I mean, some people are just trying to pass time at work or whatever, but like when people find whatever their favorite podcast is, it's not necessarily because, oh, this one episode is some all-time classic of radio, but it's because, oh, I found some people I enjoy spending time with. And that's pretty cool. That's hard to find in a lot of places.
Yeah, and as someone who writes both fiction and nonfiction, what side of that writer coin do you most identify with?
Oh, that's a good question. So when I finished grad school, I definitely I thought of myself exclusively as a fiction writer. That's why I went to school for fiction. And at least in my program, there was this weird schism between fiction and nonfiction where there was a real rivalry and like there was very little interaction. And then I ended up writing the memoir. And the first thing I ever published was an essay that ended up as a chapter in that memoir. And then the memoir happened, and then I started teaching nonfiction, and I became a nonfiction editor at Barrel House, and I said, oh shit, I have to learn how nonfiction works. and so it took me a longer time, I think, to figure out how to write fiction that I was happy with. And I think it's because like there's this I don't know if this is the right word. In nonfiction, at least the nonfiction I really like, there's a certain sort of immediacy where you don't necessarily have to build artifice around conveying a subtle emotion, but you can say, you know, I was angry when I left this place. I guess you can do it in fiction too, but at least my conception of it then was, if I wanted to convey an emotion in fiction, I had to craft this entire 3-page scene that conveyed something subtly, whereas in nonfiction I could write 2 sentences and just hit the reader with it right there. At some point I realized that's a false dichotomy and I can do kind of whatever I want, but lately, though, I mean, I've written a lot more fiction than nonfiction lately, though I don't know that it's a conscious choice to like identify as one thing or the other. It's just been I've had more fiction ideas, basically. That's what I've been excited to write about lately.
Do you wish you identified more with one with the other just so like when you hit go to the computer or go to the ledger, it's like, well, there's no choice. I'm writing fiction or I'm writing, you know, verifiably true stories.
Yeah. Sometimes I wish I was just more decisive in general, because, you know, I think most writers have some like an ideas file or something, right? And I'll have like 6 half-formed ideas, and I'll be thinking like, all right, let's pick one and start going with it. And then instead, I spend the whole morning just kind of looking at them, and then I do nothing, and I go, you know, I walk my dog, and I give up. And
such an easy thing to do. I look at my dog, I'm just saying, I give up. I'm like, yeah, you know what? A 35-minute walk sounds awful good right now.
It's healthier than just sitting down anyway. You know, yeah. There's a lot of good reasons to just go for a walk. In general, that's my more general answer, that I just wish I could be more decisive about just like, let's just write the fucking thing and see what happens.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, that's my answer. I'll stick to that. I had like a half-formed idea for another one, but it was going to end in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah. So, as with anybody who's come on the podcast and has written memoir, my first question is like, why? Like, so because it is such a it can seem very self-indulgent on one hand, but memoir when it's done really well can be uplifting and inspiring and oftentimes timeless. And I wonder, like, what made you want to write Bury Me in My Jersey? Like, what was that impetus? I was like, yes, I have to write this.
So I wrote that. So, I mean, talking about possibly self-indulgent, I wrote that when I started writing when I was 26 or maybe even 25. And so there were definitely people in my life, especially non-writer people, who were like, what are you writing a memoir for? What have you done? And where it came from for me was two things, which I tried to draw out of my students too, which is this sense of urgency and trying to understand an obsession. And so like the book is about my dad dying when I was 20, which I realize even then was not the worst thing that's ever happened to anyone with a with their dad. But it was a thing that I was still clearly not over. And I didn't realize how not over it was until I started writing about it. And the obsession part is that was the sports obsession, being like a very intense Philadelphia Eagles fan. And I wrote very little in the couple years after I finished grad school. And the first thing I wrote that I felt pretty okay about, well, I had this idea. So David Shields, before he became, you know, this guy who is trying to change how nonfiction works, and you know, before he became that guy, he had a book called Body Politic, and there's some subtitle, and it's a collection of essays about sports. And he wrote these things just about like the intersection of sports and politics and race, and they were mostly pretty interesting. And I started trying to copy him, and so I started trying to write this essay about kind of about like the weird intersection of race and class and the way that we watch football, especially like often young, poor black men being drafted into the league and playing college football and so on. And it was like this very academic essay. And I sent it to a friend to say, what do you think about it? And he said, it's really not very good. But there was one line. And that's why I sent it to that friend, because I knew he would let me know. There was this one line. The first line, it said something about, I haven't been to church since my dad's funeral 3 years ago. But and he said, that's your essay. Write about that. And it really opened my eyes. You know, it was like, oh, I didn't realize that was this thing that's kind of sneaking through. And that's, I mean, anyone who's written nonfiction, I think, has those. Like in early drafts, you realize, oh, wait, I thought I was writing an essay about, you know, going to night school or something, but I'm actually writing an essay about this other thing, this breakup or whatever the thing is. So what drove it was sort of just like maybe desperation, because I was like, oh, this is actually the first thing I'm excited to write about since I don't know when, you know, not that grad school drove it out of me or anything. It's just that like I left grad school thinking like maybe I'm not supposed to write.
What was that period like? You know, because you went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, you know, this very like prestigious writing program. And so leaving there with that feeling of almost like, do you even want to write, or and leaving there and not writing much, that must have filled you with something that that was very demoralizing in a lot of ways. Yeah. You had spent what, three years there?
Two.
So like after 2 years of that intensive kind of training, and then to then not have the energy to want to write or publish, what was that like for you?
It filled me with a certain level of dread, that's for sure. Because it was just like, you know, you're like a lot of writers, like my whole life, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be a writer. And now I went to this big fancy school. Now I get to be a writer. And then I get to the end of it and I think, oh, wait, what if this is not the thing I'm supposed to be doing? You know, and I think that's, you know, that happens to people in all kinds of fields, right? They hit a certain age and they say, wait a second, I've been trying to build toward one particular goal and it might not be the thing I want to do, or it might not be the thing I'm good at doing. I wrote some bad short stories. I had this novel that, you know, I had sort of like turned in as my thesis to graduate, and I kind of tinkered with it. But I mostly went up to my office and said I was going to work and then played video games. and then I felt terrible because I would stay up too late playing video games. And I'd wake up in the morning and think like, oh, well, that's another day. You didn't do anything. And so it was a huge relief to finally to have a friend whose opinion I respected really say like, oh, wait, this is good and publishable. And you can make a book out of this. And then when that essay got accepted by Black Warrior Review, which is a journal, probably still the best journal I've been published in. Mm-hmm. I got paid money for it. I got paid money to write. And so I said, oh, wait a second. Maybe I am a writer, you know?
That's very validating.
I felt a lot less like a fraud, you know? And because you come back and a lot of people in your life, especially people outside the writing world are like waiting now, like, okay, you did your art school thing. What are you working on? And they're being polite and they want to know, they want to say, oh, are you working on a book? And boy, I either lied to them or gave them really vague answers for a long time.
Yeah. At some point you've gone through the schooling and then you kind of, at some point you have to decide to turn pro. And,
yeah.
Do you remember what that was? It that moment when this essay was published that you're like, that's your pro moment when you kind of called yourself up and put and sort of suited up?
Yeah, man, that email, I still have the email. I have since emailed Alyssa Nutting, who was the managing editor at Black Warrior at the time, to let her know that I feel like she kind of like that was the lifeline in my, I mean, probably. In this alternate timeline where they don't accept it, probably I don't just give up writing forever. Maybe, but probably not. And probably I just go into a funk and then maybe a few years later there's some other sort of breakthrough or at least minor breakthrough where I feel a little bit better. But maybe not. I don't know. and so I'm eternally grateful. Basically, a Black Warrior Review has my undying loyalty for that, because they just and it makes me feel good. From the Barrelhouse perspective, when we sometimes accept an essay, someone will write and they'll say like, hey man, I've had a terrible run of rejections for like 2 years. And this kind of saved me. You know, one made me really sad. There was this poem I was reading for a recent issue and I liked it, but we just couldn't fit it. And I emailed the author to say that basically, I really love the poem. It's just like weird logistical issues make it hard to fit into this issue. And he wrote back and he said, it's been a long time since I've had anything published, but your email really may have saved me, because I was ready to quit on everything.
The power of like just a respectful rejection can sometimes put fuel in the tank like that.
Yeah, because it's so lonely, you know, and it doesn't go away feeling. It's just that it changes at different. It's at different levels and different directions you feel like that. Because after I published the first book, then I had a book rejected roundly by many publishing houses. And then a few years later, I had to find a new agent. And then I got rejected by a whole bunch of agents. And you that anxiety doesn't, it just comes back in different ways and different forms.
So what did being a successful writer look like to you when you were in Iowa? And how has that changed to where you are now?
Or the term that people used to use, at least when I was in Iowa, was a working writer. Someone had told, given this statistic to someone in our class, that something like 10 out of 25 people in your class will become working writers. And what that meant to me, I guess, was someone who makes enough money on their writing not to have to do anything else. I would change that definition now, which I think is probably a naive definition. Probably, well, we might have one person from our class who is at that level, maybe, actually. But that's, you know, that's actually kind of rare.
Most. I feel like all have some sort of steady gig, whether that's teaching or some form of freelance journalism or something. Like you said, it's very rare for that, for just the writing work to support. Yes, go on for sure.
Yeah, or they have a partner who makes a lot of money. Now I guess I define working writer as kind of what I'm doing. You know, like I'm publishing relatively regularly. I will have had two books out soon. And I have a regular old job teaching. But like I'm someone who has written things that have been read by people who don't know me, which now seems like a miracle. Right. And I did this thing at Virginia Tech. They had the student-run literary festival. It's called Glossolalia, and it was great. I mean, they invited me to come down along with this poet, S. Whitney Holmes, and it was students would read, undergrads and grad students, and then we were kind of the featured people. And they had 150 on a Friday night on a college campus. They had 150 people in the room, and they paid me money, and they paid for my food. And it really seemed like a miracle that I get that my job was to like just fly to a college and read some stuff to people who really like books.
That's awesome.
You know, it's like, and since that, I had a real, real moment of clarity while I was in that room, and I was like, oh my God, this is very lucky. You know, it won't stop me from complaining if like, you know, next week the novel gets a whole bunch of bad reviews, and but at least in the interim, I can remind myself that I've had more success already than I realistically expected, I think.
What were some of your, this would apply to your first book, what were some of the low attendance readings you've ever done? My lowest is four people in the back room of a historical society in Saratoga Springs. So it was cool. They were totally into it, but they buried us in the back room and I did as much publicity as I could, but they basically didn't do anything, and it was tricky. But four people showed, and we had a nice little time. But it's nice to sometimes give other writers, aspiring or otherwise, some of that sprinkling of that kind of experience will happen to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So were all four of those people strangers, or were any of them family or friends?
They were actually strangers.
Oh, that's good. So that's great.
Because my book was about the Saratoga racetrack and that season. So people in Saratoga just go gaga over the track. So it had some reach. So the people who were there were just, just some older folks who were just genuinely interested. So I was like, all right, I did a little reading and did a mini Q&A, and that was it. Signed some books and got out of there.
Yes. Yeah. It's disheartening. And you get up there and you think like, oh, should we just call this off? Should we tell the two people in the audience, let's just get a coffee or something? I had two. There was one that was in this now closed independent bookstore called Chester County Bookstore, Chester County Books in Philly suburbs. And it was a huge store. At one point, it was like this, it was a real institution, but you know how it goes. And my wife was there. One of my good friends, who's in the book a little bit, was there, and a former student was there with her mom, and the former student's mom sat in the front row reading a different book while I did my reading. And, that was discouraging. And then there was another one, which was just really bad time. I was going to read at the Borders in Center City, Philly, right downtown. So it's a great venue to possibly get people in. But the, Philadelphia Flyers, the hockey team, were playing in game 6 of the Stanley Cup that same night.
Duh.
And my book was aimed largely at sports fans. And so, boy, there was no reason to even go. Everybody who would have possibly bought that book was at home. There was one person who sat in the audience besides my wife, and that person came up afterward to ask if I can help get his book published.
Ah, nice. Nice. That seems to happen like one out of every two. Someone comes up to you with their book idea.
Yeah.
It's kind of hilarious. Earlier in our conversation, you talked a little bit about a sense of urgency, which I really like, because when I did the transcription of our first conversation, I pulled out this little passage of where you talk about that sense of urgency when people were submitting essays to Barrel House. And just a little couple sentences here. You said, I read a lot of essays when I'm reading submissions, and a lot of them are technically sound and interesting enough, but there's no sense of urgency. It doesn't feel like there's anything on the line for the writer. And I love that, because in that there's a lot of that, like you said, urgency, but intention. So in your writing, how do you make sure, how do you sort of calibrate your compass to ensure that there is urgency and that you always have something on the line in a piece of writing?
I have to say, I'm relieved that I still agree with the thing that you quoted me saying from. Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, you're like, oh no, not anymore.
Yeah. There's this assignment that I give to my nonfiction students where I tell them where the first line of the sentence or of this exercise has to be something they're terrified of telling their mother. Because I think, it's fiction too, but nonfiction especially, there's this thing in the essays I really love where I feel like the author has something to lose by having published the thing that they wrote, you know, or there's something at risk, or like they might, and that something to lose isn't necessarily like their job, but it could be a relationship, or it could be just their own sense of their own, possibly their dignity or their own sense of pride or whatever it is. And so I think the main thing I try to keep in mind if I'm reading something I wrote that I want to still feel urgent is like if I'm in a middle draft, am I bored by it? And if I'm bored by it, what's the thing that's missing? Am I holding back, or do I have, is the thing I'm writing, is the idea just not good enough, you know? So it's, I mean, that sounds like the most subjective sort of arbitrary thing, but so many times in a middle draft, you start reading and you say, oh, this is just really boring. Why would anybody ever read this thing if I don't, you know, if I'm not invested in some way?
How quick are you to discard those things that glaze your eyes when you're in the middle of the writing, or how much time do you allow it to sit there in the event that maybe it'll come around to be more relevant once you finish up and do a few rewrites?
Yeah. First drafts, I plow through without looking back at all, basically. I mean, you know, I'll make a handful of edits if I have typos and things like that, but I just roll. I try to generate a ton of words. And I know a lot of other, I have some of my friends like my co-host on Book Fight, he's very deliberate where he wants to make sure every line is right before he starts moving on. For me, that sort of paralyzes me when I do it. And so I'm pretty willing to throw a bunch of stuff out there, knowing a lot of it's going to end up going. I'll usually give things a chance through at least the third draft. Sometimes it's around draft 4 or 5 where I'm like, I keep coming back to a thing and I finally have to say, all right, Tom, you know, this doesn't work. You just have to, get rid of it now. But for me, I mean, actually that's been when I was in grad school and the years after, it was much harder for me to commit to actually deleting things. I was, you know, the whole kill your darlings thing. I agreed with it in principle, but then when it came time to actually ruthlessly edit things I was writing, I was very bad at it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I almost like to call it just like putting your darlings in prison or something. Cause I'll cut off the limb and I'll put it on in a scrap file and be like, okay, oh, yeah, this is here. This is the DVD extras. and so it's not completely killed, but invariably, man, if you've written a 5,000 word thing, if you lop off 2,000 words, it's way cooler. It's streamlined. And it's like, wow, why did I ever need that? But you did need it in a sense, but not in the final product to spare the reader. You needed it as a writer at first, but for the reader, you know, you get to that leaner state and you're like, yeah, this just moves. This is an athletic piece of writing.
Yeah, that's when I was in grad school. We were in Frank Conroy's class. He used to call those words that the writer needs, but that have to go by the final draft. He used to call that the scaffolding that you put up basically to get the work done, but you have to take it down at the end. And yeah, I totally agree. Like, and having, you know, making mistakes or having these ideas, it's, you know, sometimes you can compress a scene into one sentence and it's so much better. We were at Dave Housley and Mike Ingram and I were all representing Barrel House at this event at an MFA program. And someone asked, you know, it's sort of a hard question, but they asked like, what's the biggest mistake you see people making in submissions? And there's lots of answers. But one thing Dave said was, I don't think we've ever accepted a piece and told the author, you have to add something here. We always are telling them to cut if we're telling them things, for the exact reason you just said.
And odds are that writer probably did make what they deem to be significant cuts already.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you want to just overcorrect, you know, take a big swipe at it. And, you know, it's like we said, it's invariably better.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what advice or questions do you hear most from aspiring writers or your students who want to be like you, who are, you know, writing books and essays and living the life of a working writer?
So with students, I mean, the first they ask a lot of questions about kind of logistics, you know, how does publishing work, that kind of stuff. But then probably the most common one is like, how do you know when something is ready? You know, how do you know when something's ready to go out? And that's such a hard one to answer because, I mean, probably there are some writers who have really good answers. For me, it's such a going by feel, and it's only by having written a ton of words in the past 10 years that I know I have a pretty good feel for when I've made something as good as I can make it. But I mean, typically with students, it's that they're just like when I was a student, they're not as willing to go through and do the extra three drafts or whatever it is. Yeah, how do you know when something's ready? That's probably the biggest question. Do you have a good answer for that one?
I guess a lot of times if you're allowed to just work constantly, you'll always find things to change and to just chip away at, chisel, change this, add this. 2 weeks after you think you're done, like you hear a song that triggers a memory and it's like, oh, that's good to add. So it's almost like it will never be finished. So I feel like it's to the point where I feel like it's super, you know, it's super lean, and I just have to cut the tie and just like submit it. And being in newspapers for a bunch of years and all that, and having those kind of deadlines where it didn't have to be good, it just had to be good enough sometimes.
Yeah.
You kind of build that muscle and where you have to be fine with shipping no matter what. I would say that, but then when it invariably gets rejected, I'll be like, okay, well, let's work on it a little more and see what might have been the problem and tweak it and send it somewhere else. And yeah, so I guess that it is a feel thing. Like you write millions of words and you just kind of get a sense like, yeah, this is about as far as I can take it.
Yeah. And that thing that you said about it doesn't have necessarily to be great, it just has to be good enough, is like the idealistic young version of me would have said like, that's bullshit, man. You know, only has to be perfect, but like, it's just not. I mean, it depends what you want, I guess. But if you want to be sending stuff out on a relatively regular basis, you just have to commit to some things.
Yeah, and I think if you're submitting, you know, books or book proposals or query letters, essays to prestigious literary journals, like, yeah, that better be damn good when you send it out.
It's, yeah,
like that's not a time for it to be good enough. That has to be fucking great. You know, as great as you can make it. And because it's representing you, you know, you don't want to send off stuff that's completely and entirely shoddy.
Yeah. And the numbers game is so stacked against any individual writer on submissions to a literary journal or something like that, or for book submissions, that, yeah, you can't afford to stand out in a bad way.
Yeah. Yeah. The subjective nature of things makes it if you are, you know, technically off, if just give them one little aberration to say no. I mean, you have to be so undeniably good that, you know, they can't say no, but there are so many reasons to say no to you over the course of the editorial process. As I'm sure you know, as an editor at Barrow House, you know, there's just these little things. Like, if you can't get that right, this has got to go. I've got a big pile to get through.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So when you decide on to take on a writing project, whether it be nonfiction or fiction, what has to click into place in your head to put all of your creative energies into it?
So let's start with fiction. The voice has to be something I'm engaged and excited to write. Like, so the current book I'm working on is about the aftermath of a school shooting in this town, and it started for a long time. I had this idea that I was going to have like 10 different points of view, and I was going to do all these different characters, and it was a slog for me to even try to get into the voices of these people, and I wasn't interested, and I kept making excuses not to do it. And then finally one day I started writing this one character, this one voice, and it just like, oh, there it is. You know, I finally figured out what I wanted to sound like. Same thing with the novel that's coming out in a couple weeks, The Young Widower's Handbook, where that one happened faster, where I had this idea of this guy whose wife dies and he takes her ashes with him on a road trip across the country. And I sat down to write the first chapter, and like the first couple of sentences came out in this way. You know how like a basketball player, if they can't miss a shot, they'll say like the rim looked huge. That's how I felt when I was writing that. It was just like, oh my God, this is the easiest writing I've ever done. And so then I said, I got to go with this. Like, it gets me excited when the voice is right.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's probably true of nonfiction too. Although I probably have like pretty similar, I mean, since it's me, I have a pretty similar voice in most of my essays. And there it's sometimes I feel like I need to find some sort of, this is not the way I want to use, I was going to say a hook, but then I know they teach this. All my students want to have a hook, and that for them, that means like a catchy first sentence. I want to have some sort of emotional thing that I can hang all this stuff on. That's not just me saying, let me tell you about six things I did in a row when I went to Seattle or whatever.
Yeah, and there has to be a kind of an element of fun and play involved, yeah, too, when you're writing this kind of stuff. I know when that's what gets me into a zone. Like, I have to remind myself, like, this is kind of fun. You're lucky to get to do this. And I've heard David Foster Wallace say that, too, like, mainly referring to writing fiction. He's like, it's just, I don't know, it's just good fun, and, you know, in that really soft voice he had. And you can tell a lot of times, especially in his nonfiction, when he's having a good time. And yeah, his tennis essays, one on Federer and one on another guy, was like the number 100 player in the world, which is just brilliant.
You can Michael Joyce one.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God. I've read that like 5 times. I can't get enough of that essay. That one's just so, so good. And yeah. But you can tell he's having fun. And when you're having fun, man, it's just, you're just clicking off pages, and you know the reader's going to have a good time too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it translates when the author is really enjoying something, the same way it does when a musician is really excited and engaged in what they're doing, or a dancer or any other artist.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you say that. Like, a few years ago, this store I was working for, they got us tickets to a show, and this was in SPAC, the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, and it was like freaking Doobie Brothers in Chicago. But watching I had never seen the Doobie Brothers. I'm barely familiar with their music, but they were out there and they were just playing. They were opening for Chicago, and like after every song, the lead guitarist and lead singer, I don't even know his name, he just like pump his fist, and he was just like having the best time of his life. And I was just like, oh, that's so cool. You know, like if you can bring that to your craft, and just that love and energy behind it, it's like who isn't going to follow you into your creative fires, if you will, you know?
Yeah, and it also helps you to sell work that maybe isn't, if you're not one of the most brilliant writers of your generation, like Wallace, then it, you know, that energy is, and urgency is the sort of thing that helps you differentiate you and sell what you're doing too.
Yeah. So what do you, when do you do most of your writing? What's like that, your morning routine when you're clicking off pages? How does that start?
The best days, so I'm lucky my teaching schedule is pretty open, so I usually have like 2 days a week where I'm just at home. I don't have to be on campus at all. And so those are often very busy days for getting stuff done. Where in theory, the way it works, I'll get up, I'll have some breakfast, then I'll go up, I'll mess around on the internet for a little bit, then I'll go upstairs and I'll work until lunchtime, basically. So like a 3 to 4 hour kind of thing. Some days I spend more time on the internet than the actual work part.
Is that like a sustained block where you're just generating, or is it sometimes you kind of you're doing a little, then you step off the treadmill and then you get back on the treadmill?
If it's like a new project, it's pretty sustained usually, where I could do 3 to 4,000 words that I feel okay about, knowing they'll have to get edited. And then, it'll vary. Like right now I'm in the stages with a new thing where I'm rereading it a lot. And so like yesterday morning, my job was just sitting there reading out loud, actually, and trying to catch a lot of the stuff that didn't sound right. That's probably the primary, there's lots of variables. That's the main work thing. And on school days when I'm teaching, I'll try to get up around like 6 and try to get at least an hour of actual work in before I go, and I, kind of tire my brain out.
And were you always creating mainly in the morning? Is that just your circadian rhythm, or have you experimented throughout the day to try to, figure out what works for you?
I used to say I work better at night, but I realized that was an excuse to put the work off. And then, because it's so much, you say, oh, I'll get it done tonight, but then stuff comes up or you get too tired or whatever. So I started doing it in the morning basically to try to subvert my own worst impulses of procrastination and stuff like that.
And what is the key for you to sustaining momentum over the long haul of a novel that's 300 to 400 pages?
I struggle with that sometimes. It's often I get about halfway through and I realize like I've written myself into a corner, or this plot is going nowhere, and I don't know how to keep it rolling. And so sometimes it's grinding, like knowing that if you grind through a chunk of work that you don't feel great about, that eventually something's going to click into place. Which is not to say I'm not one of those writers that's like, you have to lock yourself in the chair for 4 hours a day, no matter what, and stare at the blank screen if nothing happens. And, but I do feel that it, for me, it's valuable to sometimes force myself to write things that I know are just not going to be good because I need to. It's like, it's almost like dislodging the bad ideas from my brain or something, which I know that's not a scientific theory. But it's, you know, kind of grinding it out for a couple of weeks sometimes. Usually, at least so far, I've found a way to like a way back in or to like rediscover whatever it is that got me excited in the first place.
How important are those maybe afternoon or long walks? How important are those to you to kind of unplug from what you're doing? And like, how do you use those to kind of, I don't know, not put gas in the tank, but to at least to unplug and get away from it so you can come back fresher?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, a lot of people have talked about that idea, right? That it's like letting your subconscious get to work, you know, coming up with ideas in the shower and those kinds of things. And I keep, you know, on my phone, I have a long list of notes and things that I think of in kind of random spots. The phone's a real lifesaver in that front, because I used to have scraps of paper everywhere and I would lose them or I couldn't read them. And yeah, it's very valuable. Kind of getting away from a thing. Sometimes, you know, when I'm in one of those periods where I'm grinding, maybe it's like, well, let's just not look at this thing for a week, and then maybe something will click into place. Maybe you'll figure something out, or, you know, that kind of magic that happens where someone says something that all of a sudden your brain rearranges everything the way it's perceiving the book.
Mm. And what other hobbies do you employ? Here I'm using that word unplug again, but from writing or reading or teaching, you know, just something that's a complete departure from your vocation to just get, you know, to feel fresh.
I watch a ton of sports. Mm-hmm. I watch a lot less football now than I used to, for a variety of reasons, but, among them concerns about kind of like the ethics of supporting an organization that seems bad.
Yeah.
In the NFL.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I kind of struggle with it too.
But I watch a lot of, I watch the NBA a lot. So that's among my hobbies, is watching the NBA and having opinions about the NBA. Then my wife, I basically hang out with my wife, going out to dinner, traveling, going to see that kind of stuff. That's where, a lot of my non-writing, reading-related energies go.
Are there any other forms of artistic media that you like to consume that kind of helps with your writing?
It would be hard to draw a direct line, but like I mean, I listen to music basically the whole time I'm working. And I know some people can't have those like competing streams in their head. But for me, it's on all the time, and what music I'm listening to varies wildly. You know, whether it's, some days it's stuff I'm picking specifically to like, because of a specific mood I'm trying to be in. But a lot of times it's just like whatever's on. And I don't, yeah, like I said, it's hard to say exactly how that helps, mm-hmm. but it's part of the whole atmosphere there. And I like watching. My wife does not like watching these, so I have to watch them by myself. I like watching very slow, sad movies about sad people. What's the movie with the long title? The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. That one. That's like my quintessential example of that's the Brad Pitt, Casey Affleck of the sort of a movie that I totally understand why some people hate them. But I kind of like to immerse myself, you know, for a long period of time in kind of a bleak movie world.
Huh. And, yeah, yeah. What book or books do you revisit the most, that you reread to kind of remind yourself, like, oh, that's how it's done?
So I'm not a huge rereader in the way, so like I know some people have, you know, like they have a certain book they'll take off the shelf once a year and reread it or things like that. I think the thing, what helps, probably the answer to this is the things that I end up assigning my fiction and nonfiction classes, where like when I'm teaching creative nonfiction, we'll read The Fourth State of Matter by Joanne Beard. And every time I say, holy shit, this is so good. I don't even know how somebody wrote something this good. You know, that's one of those essays where I read it and I think, that there's this whole like three tiers of quality of writing above what I'm doing that's inspirational, a little daunting. And it changes the way I think about it. And every time I'm excited to go back and read that one. And there's examples like that kind of on that. Actually, that's probably the one out of all the things I assign that every time I read it, I think I'm so disappointed when certain students don't like it, because I want to say like, no, you're reading one of the best things.
So, before I let you get out of here, what are you most excited about, right now with the release of the Young Widower's Handbook, as you're getting ready to really, ramp up publicity for that? What's that experience like, and what are you most looking forward to?
It's been a long waiting period since I signed the contract. I think I signed the contract in late 2014, and due to like quirks and publishing schedules and things like that, and Algonquin only puts out I think 10 novels a year, and so they could only slot me in where they could. I'm really excited. Like I finally got the actual finished books 2 days ago. I did an event at this conference where I was signing books, and so it's very exciting to see the actual book exist in the world, and we can finally get on with whatever's going to happen with it. Yeah. It's just been such a long wait where I've been. I think we waited longer for it to come out than it took for me to actually write the book, and so I'm excited to finally be out and do some events where hopefully people show up, and let the thing be in the world finally, and hopefully let it sink or swim.
Yeah, what's kind of crazy is that you're going to get people asking you questions about it as if you just finished it like Monday, but like you finished it probably, I don't know, 18 months ago or whenever you actually like put the final bow on it, and I think of course they send you revisions, but it's like you were a different person when you finished that book, and you almost have to go back in time and remember who you were when you wrote it. And it's kind of disorienting, I imagine. But anyway, it's probably going to be good fun in the end.
I hope so. We'll see. But yeah, you're right. It's definitely like, oh, let's go back to this time in my life when I was doing this, when this was the thing that was preoccupying me every day, but I've like put it away for so long.
Because now you're on to another book, and so it's like, oh yeah, I got to remember who I was and where I was and what inspired me about this book at that time. It's
right.
Yeah. Well, very nice, Tom. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, you got it. And we'll be in touch for sure.
Great.
Best of luck with the book.
All right. Thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
All right. Later, Tom.